This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, Zoom world, the Zoom realm.
Good morning.
I hope you can all hear me. Looks like you can. So this is the weekend before Thanksgiving, you're all aware. It's also the last Saturday of kind of, I would call it normal Saturday, of our fall Ango, our practice period, which began 6 weeks ago in October. So this is the last talk I'm offering as a regular Saturday thing during Ango, and I'm going to turn my attention after this to the talks I have to prepare for the winter retreat called Rohatsu, which begins in a week from today. We'll be in the Rohatsu schedule.
2 weeks.
2 weeks. 2 weeks. Thank you. I always do this. When we have a holiday, I just sort of, it just like disappears out of my mind, and I'm thinking about the next Zen thing. 2 weeks. Thank you. Yeah, you would have been surprised, wouldn't you, if I'd started Ango next Saturday. So the entire time that we've been in this Ango, you know, where we've had longer services and formal study, more retreats and talks, this has corresponded with a very intense outpouring in the world of violence, of hatred, to put it mildly, divisive speech and actions here in this country and around the world. And in fact, one particular conflict commenced the week before we began Ango. And I tried to speak about this at a couple of points during Ango, but I kept the focus, in words at least, and in my own practice, on trying to just be with things and on the refuge of practice and of the triple treasure, you know, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And I think we all know that, I'll call it the current situation, things as it is. I don't really know what to call it, but we'll call it the current situation, things as it is not unique in the history of the world, at least as human beings understand it. It's the particular suffering of our time, but it's not even the worst in the memory of our time. For example, last week during the talk, which was on the first day of a weekend retreat, I mentioned that it was the actual day that Veterans Day is observed. Right? And I mentioned that Veterans Day was originally called Armistice Day, which not everybody knew. And it marked the end of the First World War, which in its time was called the Great War, simply called the Great War. And it came to be called the War to End All Wars. That was the hope. It was so awful that it would be the war that would end all wars, if only. And the cessation of hostilities in that conflict took place at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, more than 100 years ago. So I mentioned this when I began my talk. But as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about today, I wondered just how many people perished in the two world wars. I knew the number was big, but I had forgotten how big. So, does anybody know? Anybody here a kind of history buff?
About 120 million between both world wars.
Approximately. Many of them were civilians, right? We have armies, but death is not confined to armies. So it's hard to know in the First World War. but at least 8.5 million, 8.5 million soldiers, and an estimated, one estimate is 13 million civilians. And the totals for the First World War, the Great War, are difficult to ascertain because of the nature of warfare, trench warfare, mechanized warfare, the first time that was happening, and also the effects of displacement, starvation, genocide, and the great influenza outbreak of 1918, which happened at the same time and affected the war. And that war, of course, we all know, I think, set the stage for the Second World War, which came really quickly, considering the first one was the war to end all wars. And in that war, according to the website of the National World War II Museum, here are the statistics for the Second World War. Battle deaths, 15 million. Civilian deaths, 45 million. 24 million people in the Soviet Union alone. 7 to 8 million in Germany, and that doesn't count everyone in the Holocaust. Tens of millions in China. At least 22 million in China. Maybe as many as 50 million. And in these numbers, the unknown or imperfectly known toll is very high, right? But our rounding error is on the scale of hundreds of thousands or millions of individual human lives. And it is impossible, really, to take this in. It's impossible to accept that this happened, but it did. And it's still happening, although currently not quite at this scale. We are still at it. And some of the fighting and hatred and cruelty that are happening now are rooted in the specific aftermaths of the agreements among the victorious powers that ended both of those wars. And so the karma of those conflicts didn't end with an armistice or a settlement or a treaty. It didn't. One war seeds the next. And for the Second World War, but also the First World War, I feel some personal karma. I mean, obviously I was not alive for either of these conflicts. But members of my own family fought in both of these wars. My grandfather in the First World War, and my step-grandfather was a medic in the trenches in France in the First World War. And my father fought in the Pacific and wound up in Japan after the war in the occupation forces of Tokyo. For a year, he was in Tokyo. And I knew this, it was part of our family history. My father kept everything related to the war. He had his uniforms, he had his footlocker. He was young, in his 20s, when he fought, and it made a big impact on him, although he did not speak about it very much. And it was during the commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Japan that I actually directly connected with the karma I actually was carrying about this. It was 2005, and I was in San Francisco. This is just coincidence, or karma, whatever you want to call it. I was in an intensive summer practice period at the San Francisco Zen Center. And while we were engaged in this practice, a ship arrived from Japan, including a contingent of monks, Buddhist monks, and they were bringing with them lanterns that had been lit from the flames of the two Japanese cities that had been bombed in 1945. So there was these little, you know, lanterns with glass sides. And they had kept these flames alive for 60 years, continuously. That's the time on a long cycle of mourning, when mourning can end, 60 years. So the mourning was for these deaths in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Was going to end with this arrival in San Francisco. So the monks were going to walk in pilgrimage from San Francisco to New Mexico to the Trinity site where the bomb was first tested. And when they arrived, they were going to extinguish these flames and try to end the cycle. And there were people on the dock waiting to receive them, Americans, or people who had emigrated to America after the war, who were survivors of the bombings. And one of them stepped up to the microphone with his companion dog. He needed a dog to help him. I spontaneously burst into tears, standing there in my blue rakusu on the dock in San Francisco. And I found myself apologizing also to my father, who firmly believed that if we had not dropped the bomb, he would not have come home. He would have died in the war. And there were some speeches by the survivors who were present, and then the monks set out, and we walked with them. The public spontaneously just joined them and walked. And we, from the San Francisco Zen Center, also walked with them. And at a certain point, we all turned back. They were on pilgrimage. And I wished I could go with them. And at this time, or around this time, leading into the 60th anniversary, people were making thousands of folded origami paper cranes to send to Hiroshima and Nagasaki as a symbol of peace. And they were also making figures of a bodhisattva called Jizo, a protector, among others, of women and children, particularly protector of women and children. And this practice, the making of the cranes and also especially the Jizo images, was the project of a Zen priest and teacher named Jan Chosen Bays. She is co-abbot at the Great Vow Temple in Oregon. And she was born on the day that the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. And she decided, when her 60th birthday was approaching, and with it the 60th anniversary of the bombing, she decided to make 60 figures of Jizo, this bodhisattva protector, and to take them to Japan for the 60th anniversary. And in preparation for this, she went to Japan, and she realized from going to the sites and the commemorative displays that actually 270,000 people had died in the bombings, either on the day itself or within a year. And she thought of the many children who had died. She herself was a pediatrician. Trained as a pediatrician. So her vow went from 60 figures of Jizo to send 270,000 images of Jizo to Japan. And she started to share this vow. She didn't know how she was going to accomplish it. That's a lot of Jizos. It's a lot of figures. But to make a long story short, in the end, 334,000 images were made and sent to Japan, and they were created by people of all faiths all over this country. And they represent atonement. And because she did not want artistic skill or lack of it to be any kind of factor in people's ability to join this practice, she made rubber stamps of different sizes and different designs for people to stamp onto cloth or paper. And people created quilts and banners based on these images and decorated them and wrote messages on them and often included pictures of themselves. So this was like a personal practice that was sent to people in Japan as a personal gesture. And I participated in a workshop in the Chapel Hill Zen Center to make these images. And that was really my first, those two things, the arrival of the monks on the dock in San Francisco and the Jizo making workshop, were my first opportunities to actually orient myself to practicing with Jizo and Jizo's walk, the walk of pilgrimage. And so it occurred to me, I kind of recalled all of this and thought, maybe sharing the practice of Jizo, walking with Jizo, might be a way for us to address this unfathomable, unbelievable time that we're in and burden we're carrying. And I'm inviting a friend who knows how to do ceremonies that focus on Jizo to come sometime in the new year and conduct a workshop and a ceremony for us to practice with. And then we can incorporate it, if we want to, in our continuing practices here in Austin. So you may, just how many of you know anything about Jizo already? I've encountered Jizo, several of you. So Jizo is that figure actually out in the foyer, the gold guy.
And the 704 now?
Sorry?
The 704?
No,
the
he's there.
The tall sky, is it true?
Nope, he's the little gold one.
Oh, okay.
Who's on and above the fireplace? Yeah. So you can take a look when you on your way out. So I want to talk about this bodhisattva, who's now our work altar, right? We offer incense. We sort of just treat him like a Buddha figure, but he's a very specific figure. He's especially venerated in Japan, and he's very embedded in, I'm going to say he at first, but I'm not going to stick with that pronoun. He is very embedded in Japanese culture and in Buddhist practice. And we don't hear about him so much in our particular stream of Soto Zen, but he is making his way into American Zen practice, which is where this ceremony that I'm talking about really comes from. You know, one of the bodhisattvas that is quite prominent, like Kanon or Kuan Yin, or we also call her Avalokiteshvara, right? The bodhisattva of compassion, or Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, or Samantabhadra, whose name we mention in our meal chant. That's the bodhisattva specifically presiding over practice, the shining practice bodhisattva. So we have Jizo also. So originally in India, Jizo, which is the Japanese name, has this name. It's Kshitigarbha. Kshitigarbha. Which means something like earth womb bodhisattva, or earth store bodhisattva, or even earth treasure bodhisattva. But the thing that all of those epithets, translated epithets, have in common is that is the earth, right? This deep, primal, fundamental element. And actually this bodhisattva, in all the stories told about him, has both male and female aspects and can appear in both male and female bodies. So I'm going to refer to them as they, here on out. Kshitigarbha traveled, bodhisattva, like Kanon, from India and eastward to China and Korea and Tibet. So they all have their own practices in these cultures and different forms of Buddhism, and Jizo has different attributes and functions, but some common elements, always revered as a protector and a savior. You can call on Jizo and ask for help, and Jizo will appear in one form or another. And especially in Japan, there are many stories about Jizo's intervention in actual people's lives, some going back to the medieval period, but some modern day examples too, sort of, you know, miracles. And some of the characteristics that all forms of Jizo has, all forms of Kshitigarbha, is they are benevolent. and they are unshakably optimistic. They never give up. And they're energetic. And they're fearless. And they offer fearlessness. Now, there's a sutra about this figure from which we get a lot of information about the qualities, characteristics, and function of this bodhisattva. There's a sutra called The Past Vows of Earth Treasury Bodhisattva. And in that sutra, Kshitigarbha speaks to the dying Buddha. This is part of the unshakable nature of this bodhisattva. They speak to the dying Buddha and they assure him, because the Buddha's worried. There are all these beings that have not been saved, and he's worried about what's going to happen after he dies. And Kshitigarbha assures him that they would work forever for the liberation of all beings and not let them fall in or remain in realms of suffering. And they make this vow three times, and the Buddha is reassured and pleased and promises that after many kalpas, which is like a, you know, unknowably large period of time, after many kalpas of such effort, Kshitigarbha would become a Buddha. So this is one of the aspects of being a bodhisattva. You don't cross over and into nirvana completely. You hang around in the realms of suffering to help beings. So Buddha said, your endless vow, but some point you will become a Buddha. So why is this bodhisattva associated with the earth? Well, the Reverend Chosen Bays, whom I mentioned, and I want to say I'm very indebted to this book helping me to organize my own thoughts about this talk and this figure. She's very devoted to Jizo, has written this book, Jizo Bodhisattva. Everything you want to know is in here in a very accessible form. I'll say more about how she practices at her temple now with this bodhisattva a little bit later. But what she says is she connects this earth origin, or this earthy quality, this earthy connection of Kshitigarbha, with the earth as witness to the Buddha's meditation and vow that he would not move from under the Bodhi tree until he had realized full awakening. Right. So he sits down and he says, I'm not getting up until I understand the nature of reality. And to do this, the Buddha had to vanquish Mara. Mara, who tries to move him from his seat, who tries to frighten him and to tempt him, right, to try to get him to give up his quest to come to complete and total enlightenment. And the Buddha defeats Mara and Mara's armies. And this is a part of the Earth Store Bodhisattva Sutra, which I don't think is a very common version of this, of his realization story. This version says, Mara, with his army defeated, asks the defeated armies, like, well, how could we lose, right? Haven't I, Mara, you know, delusion, been generous and kind? And what proof does the Buddha have of his generosity and kindness, right? And a voice from the earth, Buddha of course touches the earth as his witness, and a voice from the earth in this sutra, the earth itself speaks to bear witness, and a deity emerged in the form of a beautiful woman, emerged halfway up to her waist, before the Buddha. She's sometimes identified with a Hindu goddess, Prithivi, an earth goddess. Anyway, she spoke and said, Mara, you don't have it. The Buddha has it, but you don't. And then turned directly to the Buddha and spoke to him and praised him and then disappeared back into the earth. So, according to this sutra, the first appearance of this figure, Kshitigarbha, is in a female form. An earth treasury bodhisattva can take many forms, and not just human forms. So, like the Buddha-like figure out in the foyer can look like a Buddha and look male, wearing a monk's robe, but can also be female, can be a god, can be a dragon, can be a spirit or a ghost, or manifest as mountains, forests, streams, springs, lakes and rivers, whatever benefits living beings. So Jizo is not limited, and Jizo's vow is unlimited. And Chosen says that a cry for help, when we turn to the away from our sense that we have everything that we could possibly need and don't need any support by from anything, right, that we're self-sufficient, a cry for help produces one of these, what she calls, transformation bodies. So our need or request for help causes bodhisattva, these bodhisattva manifestations, to arise. And in fact, she says, we on the bodhisattva path, we're all bodhisattvas, are all transformations of Jizo, and our vows are limitless. So we can begin to see how Jizo is not separate from us. Right? So this bodhisattva, like others, can be recognized by their attributes, by the things they carry or what they wear. So in the foyer, we have a Jizo that is carrying one of these, this staff, which is called a shakujo. That's a very common attribute. Most often Jizo is standing because a pilgrim is walking, right? Sometimes they sit down and rest, but often they are standing. And this ringed staff, it has these rings that can move, is a pilgrim's staff, specifically a pilgrim's staff. And the Buddha said that his monks could carry it to ward off poisonous creatures as they walked, right? To, you know, snakes and scorpions would hear it and scoot, but also to warn animals that the pilgrim was coming on the path. But it also lets people who are suffering in the hell realms know that Jizo is coming. Usually these staffs have six rings, and most often, though, they're interpreted as referring to the six realms of existence, which are the six realms of living beings. So Jizo walks through all the realms without hindrance, and the rings represent that actually he is and represents all realms. According to the Buddha, as paraphrased by, again, Chosen, all life is in motion, ceaselessly moving among the five realms of hell, the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, the human realm, and the realm of the gods. And the sixth, actually, is the Asuras, a realm of angry divinities, sometimes they're called titans, that was actually added later to the original five. That's how we get to six. And the Buddha talked about these realms and describing them in his teaching as they would be experienced by someone traveling through them. So the traveler, in the way Buddha talked about them, is tired and hot and thirsty, right? And all of those things that we sometimes experience. And we are lucky to be humans because we human travelers in the human realm are able to find shade and a good surface on which to rest. This is how the Buddha characterizes our existence in the human realm. So we're fortunate. The gods, you would think the gods would have it better than we do, but Buddha said, not really. The gods rest on couches spread with blankets, and they have nice pillows and, you know, luxurious sheets, but they're in a room in a mansion that's locked and all the shades are drawn, and they're actually trapped by luxury. Right? There's no practice going on. And the Buddha says, nirvana is release from all of these realms. And he compares it to a plunge into cool and clear water. And bodhisattvas are beings who remain to help people, to help beings in all these realms, and in particular two of them, Kannon, or Avalokiteshvara, and Jizo return to these realms by choice to save all beings. They appear when we need them. So, Jizo has another attribute, which our figure out in the foyer has. It looks like a lump of something in their hand, and this is a wish-fulfilling jewel. And the wish-fulfilling jewel... Here's my... Did I lose my page on this? Yeah. There we go. Sorry, I lost... There we go. The wish-fulfilling jewel is called the Chintamani jewel. And I'll return to that later, but those are the two most common things. So, besides that form of standing Jizo with these two attributes, probably the one that is most familiar to people, especially if you are interested in Japanese culture, are the many, many hundreds, even thousands, of simple stone or sometimes wooden figures at Japanese temples, and they're now appearing here in the so-called West. And they often have clothing, actual clothing, little like doll clothes, in red and white. And they take the form of the bibs or rakusu that some of us wear, small little hats or cloaks. And these are sewn by temple members and pilgrims, and they're regularly renewed. When they start to fall apart or fade, they're made again. And these figures greet visitors to cemeteries as well as to temples. And since the 20th century, this is not a very ancient practice actually, but since the 20th century, a ceremony has arisen in Japan to acknowledge specifically the loss of children through untimely death, stillbirth, violence, abortion. This ceremony has arisen in Japan and it's now come to America. And it's been a great help, especially for women, but also for parents and family as well, of people who have been lost. And I don't think I've ever told anybody this, so I'm going to tell you. I have wanted to do this ceremony ever since I learned of it, ever since I heard about it, for my baby brother, who died 4 days after he was born, and he never came home. And I never met him. All I have is his name, Mark. He was given a name. And as I got older, about the time I've turned 60 actually, I realized there was something unresolved for me in that loss after 60 years. My father never spoke of it, never spoke about it. So I feel called to address this long ago loss. So this particular ceremony kind of calls to me. This is another piece of my own personal karma. But practicing with Jizo is not exclusively for women. And it's not only about children, even though there's a very prominent aspects of his practice in Japan. And, you know, aspects of this figure can be found in the Sujiki ceremony we did a couple of weeks ago, right? When I carried the staff and shook it, right? I'm knocking at the gates of hell when I do that. So death of any kind, loss of any kind, sickness, travel, you know, a kind of liminal state where one might be in danger, or one might experience fear. Birth, all transitions, these are all traditional occasions on which to call upon Jizo. Now Chosen says something really interesting also about the human realm. She says it contains all the others. So we shouldn't think of them as separate, like we're here in the human realm. And then the animals are over here, and the gods are over here, right? And, you know, certainly not the hungry ghosts. Ha. She says, and this is a quote, "The non-human realms are all aspects of our own awareness, states of mind and feelings that arise within us at different times." She says, "Our life, our human life, consists of rapidly fluctuating experiences as human animals, human gods." These are hyphenated words, and so forth. From this perspective, only the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are truly human, having realized the purest and highest human potential. She says, they are fully aware of the flux of thoughts in the mind, the feelings in the heart, and sensations in the body, but they are not caused to suffer by them. That's the end of the quote. And that's why Jizo and bodhisattvas in general can offer no fear. This this is another attribute of some images of Jizo. They raise their hand, their right hand, in this mudra, this gesture, which is the no fear gesture. So they offer no fear, raising the right hand and palm out. And some Buddhas do this as well, not just Jizo. So no fear is one of the gifts of a bodhisattva, and specifically of Jizo. Now, the Shakujo staff is said to be so powerful that if Jizo strikes the gates of hell, they open. But the staff, according to Chosen, is not outside of us. Right? We think it's a thing, and it's a prop, or it's a, like I say, an attribute or a tool. Right? But it's not outside of us. Right? Jizo is supremely optimistic and vows not to give up until all beings are rescued from every karmic hell. And they also carry this jewel that I mentioned, the car figure. And about this, Chosen connects the figure, the image of a jewel which shines and refracts light, with a pearl, the great pearl of all existence, which Dogen writes about. And she quotes a Zen master named Gensha, who taught, this is a paraphrase of Gensha, the whole universe in 10 directions is one bright pearl. What use is understanding? Trying to figure it out. To which Dogen, our Japanese founder, added, even though it seems to be continually changing, the outward appearance of its turning and not turning, this is the pearl, it is just the bright pearl. Those who think I cannot be the bright pearl should not doubt that they are the pearl. This is another way of expressing our non-separation from all beings and all phenomena. And Keizan, a successor of Dogen, added, although it is an ordinary jewel, it does not come from outside, but rather appears completely from the human mind. If you use this jewel when you are ill, the illness is cured. If you wear this jewel when you are worried, the worry will dissipate on its own. All treasures appear from this jewel, and it is said that no matter how much it is used, it's inexhaustible. So Chosen invites us to be the pearl, to be the jewel, and to manifest the Jizo we are. In fact, our own existence is a manifestation of Jizo. We wouldn't be here if somebody hadn't called for help, and we are the help. We are Jizo. Chosen also challenges us in a very direct way, and I want to read this, not to rely on the props, right? The jewel is a kind of pointer, as is the staff. And this is a pretty tough teaching that she offers, but I'm going to offer it to you. It reminds me of what Thich Nhat Hanh has said also about not separating from those who do evil and thinking we are not them. We are. She says, if you think that samadhi, emptiness, equanimity, no attachment, no self is your support, fine, she says. Try it. Really try it. Remove all supports. No teacher, no friends, no lover, no Buddha, no Dharma, no Sangha. Try it in an earthquake. Try it in a famine. Try it when attacked. Try it in a war. Faced with the suffering of millions of beings, How does cold emptiness and placid unmoving function? How then does the memory of a wonderful experience of quiet mind that you had a week ago, even a second ago, serve you or others? She says, go beyond artificial, temporary supports, beyond the emptiness that is at their core and is the field of their activity. How does the great staff function? And then she offers us something, because that really kind of leads us nowhere, right? It's pretty bleak. She says, where is the staff of Jizo Bodhisattva? She said, it's also our spine. Erect in the noble posture of the Buddha. It is body, breath, and mind. Aligned in one straight line. All supporting the activity of that great body-mind, which is not two different things. We sit here in between. Why do we sit erect in Zazen? To make our spine the staff that holds heaven and earth apart, providing a space between for human activity, for enlightenment. In our work to make Jizo's staff thoroughly our own, to awaken completely to that big mind beyond naming, which functions within us, no matter whether we are aware of it or not, no matter whether we are awake or asleep or dreaming, it's our job to make it so much a part of our functioning that it becomes us. No longer is it we who are practicing, but it is the practice that practices us. The staff is nothing but up, down, up, down, up, down as we walk with Jizo. It is Jizo's staff of Dharma truth that keeps us upright and balanced. We can use the staff to cross rivers of impermanence and suffering that almost overwhelm us. And we can walk the dark paths one step, one moment at a time. So do not doubt that you are the bright pearl and that you manifest Jizo. Let yourself trust that that's true. And so there are many practices that we could adopt, but there's one that if you're curious, I will share with you now, and you could decide if you want to take it up. You can cultivate by reciting the name of Jizo. Right, so we do this, right? We say, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. You can take refuge in Jizo Bodhisattva. And you can just say, in a moment of stress or doubt or overwhelm or grief, when things fall apart, or when you want to summon the courage to do what you think you need to do to save someone else, you can just say, I take refuge in Jizo Bodhisattva 3 times, 5 times, 7 times, 9 times, 108 times, 1,000 times, many as you want. You can say it in more of a Sanskrit way, Namo Kshitigarbha Bodhisattva. Or you can make it a very positive, kind of encouraging statement. Homage to Jizo Bosatsu. That's how you say Bodhisattva in Japanese. Jizo Bosatsu, ruler of all vows. Or, and I like this one because this is kind of how I'm built, you can say the Jizo mantra. Jizo has a mantra in Japanese. And I learned this at Great Vow Monastery, which is where Chosen practices. She's created a huge garden of Jizos, all different types of figures wearing different kinds of clothes and attributes. There's even a phone out in the middle of this garden in the woods that says, call Jizo, call on Jizo. And one of the practices is to make a vow and bring it to the Jizo shrine in a procession, read your vow aloud and ring a bell. And we did this when I was there as a visitor. And so as we walked from the temple to the shrine, we chanted the mantra. And she also has a big altar to Jizo in a very large zendo that they practice in. So the mantra is Om. You know that syllable, right, everybody? Because of yoga, everybody knows Om. Om ka kabi sammae sohaka. Om ka kabi samma e soaka. Try it. Om ka kabi samma e soaka. Om ka ka kabi samma e soaka. Om ka kabi samma e soaka. You could chant it while you're walking. You could chant it during kinhin, quietly, silently. And just so you know what it kind of means, like mantras are like a mystical set of syllables. Om, right, so mantra by itself. And it's also a common opening word in many other mantras, like this one. So this, you know, is the absolute perfection of the relative world of our everyday life activity, is what Chosen says. And soaka is svaha, right, in Sanskrit. It means, you know, like, so be it. Or as one teacher said to me, far out. All right. And the syllables between om and soaka, which are typical beginning and ending words in mantras, those are the ones that invoke Jizo. And the syllable ka is called a seed syllable, and it contains the power of the whole mantra of the deity, just this one syllable, which is why we call it a seed syllable. And ka represents kshitigarbha, kshitigarbha, bha. So the Sanskrit letter A is a symbol of the ultimate reality we emerge from and return to. And when a child dies in Japan, the seed syllable K-A is written at the top of their name plaque. And so this invokes the protection of this particular figure for the child who has left this life. So that's what it means. Om ka ka kabi sammae soaka. So we'll see about when we can extend this practice, and if it resonates with you, we'll continue it. Thank you. I forgot my show and tell. A friend of mine who practiced at Great Vow and who's an artist started making Jizos out of clay. She was more of a painter and illustrator, but she started making them out of clay. And, you know, they're like, they can just be very simple. This is more like the earth, reflects more the earth origin. Here are three that she just made a whole, I forget how many she made, and she just brought them to the Zen Center one day and said, take them with you. And here's one that's a seated Jizo that somebody got for me, not knowing that I like Jizo. Brought it back, I think, from India, maybe, but I don't think it's Japanese, and it's made in a mold, but it's the seated Jizo carrying the staff and the jewel. So this is the Jizo is hanging out somewhere waiting for the call. And somebody very dear to me died about 10 years ago, and I knew where they had scattered, his family had scattered his ashes, and I went to the shore of that place, and I picked up this water-worn bark and this other piece of bark, and I set up my own little Jizo, which will not stand up straight unless I work at it, but you get the idea. So once you start looking for Jizo, you find them everywhere, or you find them everywhere. Any questions, comments, thoughts? Maybe you've got that 1,000-yard stare.
More of a comment, I guess, or a question. Research material and stuff you just discussed, where would you recommend to look for those of us who have minds that evaporate quickly after?
That book. Yeah, Jizo Bodhisattva. It's a great place to start. There's also a lot on the internet. There's a website that has a, it's has a funny origin. Someone who I think is just very interested in Japanese art, but also is a source for carvings and images of various forms of Japanese bodhisattvas and Buddhas, has a huge section on Jizo, because there are literally hundreds of specifically Japanese manifestations of Jizo that you can call upon for everything from losing a child to passing your exams. You know, I mean, Jizo is something between a divinity and a saint, like as close to human beings as saints are in Christianity, especially in Catholicism. You know, and you can call on a specific saint for a specific purpose, and it doesn't matter how mundane it is. Right? So Jizo is really close, and it's supposed to put us in the mind of helping and being helped, of the emptiness of helper and helped. It's just help. It's just protection. Yeah. But this is the place to start, I think. Yeah, Pat?
I'm really intrigued by this ceremony, workshop that's going to happen. Can you say anything more about it? Is it planned yet?
I'm hoping that... this friend of mine, some of you met at Branching Streams or might have run into her in the past, is Ryushin Andrea Thatch, who's a disciple of Mel Weitzman. She's also a physician. And this practice started, I think, in our lineage with Yvonne Rand at Green Gulch Farm, who did it specifically for women who were grieving lost children, and loss broadly, you know, defined, including things that they had never admitted to anyone, you know, like abortions at a very young age, you know, before they were married, a lot of secrets, you know, and decided to talk about the ceremony and offer it and just see who came. And the first time they offered it, like 35 women showed up. And the oldest woman in the group was the first one to speak and had never spoken about her experience that she had come to address. And then everybody felt like they could address it. So it started with a very particular focus, again, taken up from the Japanese practice they call children who are lost water babies, especially if they're premature births or aborted children or stillborn. And it's a way of resolving grief and karma and allowing these lives to return to the source. And it can happen, you can do this at any time. It doesn't have to be at the time of loss. So that focus is a possibility. No one has asked for this, but I'm sure if it were offered, there would be people who would come forward, women would come forward. But I would like to also focus on Jizo as a figure all of us can be and relate to. And that's one focus and one aspect that's important, but not the only one. And Jizo specifically protects women and children because they have fewer defenses and are more at risk in pretty much all societies. So, but men are not excluded, right? So parts of the basic form of this is partly a workshop, but it's a silent practice of making offerings to Jizo, whether it's a figure that's at the temple or your own, or figures that are provided. And materials are provided, very simple stitching or gluing or cutting, and you make these offerings, and there's chanting, and the mantra is invoked, and people share their experiences and go forth. But I would like it to be especially the first time I do it, I think I'd like it to be a broad practice that we can all enter. Because we all have suffered loss and we all have secret grief. Or not so secret. But I think it can benefit all of us. And I feel especially, given the just this devastating state we're in, and this violence, and some of it's gendered, and a lot of people who are suffering are civilians. Civilians have been targeted. Civilians are being targeted everywhere. All lives are precious, but there's something particularly upsetting to me about the toll on civilians. What helps? What can we do? This might be one thing. I sense some movement somewhere. Hi, Rich. Yeah.
Hi. I could just say from my own experience of making offerings to that altar that I sometimes reflect on what his example means to me. And as someone who works with kids with sometimes multiple disabilities, I've lost kids. I've worked with kids and died. And it's a comfort to me to think about, yes, there's grief, yes, but I have to keep going because there's still kids who need my help, you know, and I need to keep it together, like have the strength to continue, you know, and so that's what it appears to me as like an architect, a way for me to sort of emulate that example.
There's comes to mind two things. One is when Chosen was practicing with a Japanese teacher in Japan. A middle-aged Japanese woman came to visit and looked at this white woman in Buddhist robes and said, "Do I know you?" And Chosen was like, "No, I'm sure we haven't met, you know, but welcome." And the teacher was making tea for them, and she kept looking at Chosen and saying, you look really familiar." And finally she said to her, she kept very surreptitiously looking at, glancing at her. And she finally said, I recognize you. You have the face of the Jizo on my altar." And she had been practicing, with Jizo already for a long time. So there's something about becoming your vow, becoming the Bodhisattva, the Buddha that you are aspiring to, that when you practice with something like this, happens. You know, you don't look outside yourself and you see what needs to be done. You see others struggling and you step outside yourself because there isn't anything else. Right? And then it's endless because there's always beings that need help, whether they're children or others. I will say, if you read this book, just a trigger warning for some of us, that one of the things that Chosen has done in her professional capacity is she has dealt with children who are being physically and psychologically abused, and some of whom are murdered. And she talks about that unresolved grief as well, something that Jizo helped her with. But she, you don't have to be a person just dealing with children or with that level of trauma. You know, she says sometimes people in retreat come in and start crying, and they're struggling not to cry because they don't want to. They think that, I'm not really practicing if I'm crying. I've lost my equanimity. But she says part of it is people are afraid that if they start crying, if they touch the place where that grief is, they'll never stop crying. So, you don't have to be a hero to be a hero.